giant robot smashing into other giant robots.
Hey everybody, this is Ben Orenstein from ThoughtBot. This is the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast, and it is Friday, July 20th. Now today we're going to be talking with David Tierson, and David is a previous client of ours. We worked with him on a project called Staddleship. It was about an 8-week engagement, and David worked in the office alongside with us, writing code next to us on his app. His idea for Staddleship was a place that sport fans could go to make predictions about upcoming sports events and sort of join each other in making guesses about what was going to happen. So in this podcast, we're going to cover what it's like being a solo entrepreneur, what it's like learning to code Ruby at the ThoughtBot office, and other similar topics. Hope you enjoy. So I'd like to get into your background a little bit first. So you used to work for a consultancy. You helped run a consultancy somewhere in San Francisco?
I used to work for a couple consulting firms. First was a consulting company that was based here in Cambridge called Seabridge Internet Solutions, which was of the, you know, the Cyient, Viant, Sapient, Agency.com, Razorfish mold of things.
Okay.
But then in around 2002-03, when everything else fell apart, there were about seven of us that were on a project down in San Antonio, Texas. And we'd all basically were going to lose our jobs.
Yeah.
So the client really liked us, and seven of us got together and said, you know, the client still wants to work with us. We have an opportunity now to start something on our own. So at that point in time, we were still a consulting firm, and we did work for them, and they were an oil and gas company. They were one of the larger refiners in the U.S. But as the time as we went along, we realized that we were having an expertise in oil and gas. So at around 2005, about 2 or 3 years later, we started to productize our deliverables. Mm-hmm. We were customizing and custom building applications almost and over again, and we're taking all of that code into a sort of a shared pattern library. And we said, well, you know, we could productize it. So we turned into a product services company around 2005, 2006, and focused all on oil and gas.
And were you a developer for this company? Were you writing code at this point?
At the earlier part, when there's seven people, everybody was doing everything. You know,
okay.
we were designing logos. We were going on sales calls. We were developing. We were, you know, doing customer management. But primarily at that time, I was doing a little bit of project management and testing and some coding, but not very high level.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we moved into the product side of things, that's when we established a product, you know, product division.
Mm-hmm.
And there were about three or four of us in that. And that's when we focused on that. And, 5 years later, we took that product and had professional services wrapped around it. And we've been working with a lot of large oil and gas companies, and were able to sell the company in 2010.
So that kind of brings us up into today, right? Saddleship?
Right.
So
right.
Tell me about that.
So that had been an idea that my first idea for Staddleship isn't what Staddleship is now, and that's kind of the interesting part.
Mm.
I'd moved back from San Francisco in 2010, and for about a year, I just didn't been doing some consulting work on the side, but I also had Bruton season tickets for the first time ever, which happened to be a good year for that first time Bruton season tickets. Mm. And as I'm sitting there, you know, in game 32 during the second intermission, I start thinking about, okay, well, it's my 32nd game. I'm sitting here. Nothing's going on for 20 minutes. You can only watch Ice Girls and you know, the little tykes run around for a while. And I said, well, you know, there must be something else I could do during a sports event, during this hockey game, that would keep me entertained as a fan, that would, you know, that would just be kind of fun. And I'd been bouncing around an idea for about 4 or 5 months, and it came to the summertime. And I said, well, I'm either going to build this myself. So I bought some books, watched some videos like everybody else does, because my development background was web development, and the last stuff we were doing was you know, C#, because we had to be a Microsoft shop, because if you're in an oil and gas Fortune 500 company, you have to be a Microsoft shop.
Mm-hmm.
So took that as a task for the summer. And what I realized was I could learn from these books, I could learn from these videos, I could learn from, you know, these little practices. But really how you learn is through patterns and by following best practices. And as I was watching one of the videos, I think it was they were describing the factory girl testing approach. And then, of course, they mentioned you guys. And I realized, hey, you guys are down the street because I live in Boston here. And I started looking at you guys and I said, you know, this makes a lot of sense. You know, why? If you're going to learn Rails, if you're going to learn how to start a company, if you're going to learn how to take on a project and do it well, why not do it well from the beginning? Mm-hmm. You know, why not take that time and that initiative to not do, you know, a crap job? Because the only thing you'll do is you'll start repeating bad patterns, and that's the hardest thing to get away from. And yeah. And I know that from, you know, developing our oil and gas logistics platform, there came a point in time where you're just, well, I'll just keep doing the same thing that I'm doing before. You know, I'll just do it over and over and over again. Doesn't necessarily have to be the great solution, but that's it. So I came to you guys with an idea, and it was kind of funny because it was I had to pitch this idea to you guys. I was joking with some of my friends. It was like, I would like to give ThoughtBot some money to help me develop a project. And they're like, we don't know if we want to work with you.
Yeah.
You know, please pitch your idea and we'll see if we like you, if we like your idea, if you're interesting and the idea is interesting enough that, you know, we'll let you pay us to do something.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny.
It is. We're extremely fortunate in that we have a good number of people that want to work with us.
Right,
and
right.
So we can kind of flip this process on its head a little bit, which is, I think works out really well, actually.
It does. When it confused me from the very beginning. A lot of things confused me at the very beginning of the project because I was coming from that older mindset of project management where, you know, because I spent those 6-7 years in pure corporate world where, okay, here's our RFP. You digest your RFP. Here's your scope document. Here's the list. Here's the calendar. Here's the timeline. Here are the workshops. And basically after 2 weeks, you deliver a document. This is what we're going to do. And that's what they agree to. And that's what they sign. That's what you build. Mm. And that's just the way things got built. So when I came here, I think the contract was like, we will build your idea. Or, you know, that's a little sarcastic, but, you know, we'll help you realize and actualize your concept. And I was thinking, but what are the 12 features that I want? You know, and it was strange the first couple of days, but that was after I passed the audition.
Right.
It was kind of neat. Yeah. But what I found out within that very first week, or those first, let's say, 7 days, that's going into like maybe the Monday of the after the first week, was the idea I had, which you guys liked, I liked, my friends liked, everybody I pitched it to liked. We did a 1 week quick, let's bang out the basic, you know, the one feature of this idea, take a look at it, and as I stood back from it that next Monday. It's like, I don't like this idea.
Yeah.
And it was somewhat disheartening because, you know, you think you've knocked this around for 3 or 4 months. But when I looked at it and when everybody looked at it, you know, said, this isn't fun. It was going to be, it's Saddleship at its core is a game. And when you looked at it, it said, this isn't a fun game. I'm not going to have fun playing this. I'm not going to have fun working on this.
I think that's actually a common experience. I've worked on a couple projects now with clients where we're doing like greenfield applications. Like they have the idea and the idea is very fleshed out, and we build it and we're 2 weeks into it, and then we throw away the idea and do something extremely different. Like as soon as like the rubber meets the road and you actually have a thing and you click on it and you look at it and you try it, you're like, actually, we don't like this.
No, exactly. So had I gone, even let's say with another consulting firm who did the other approach where I listed out those 24 features and time box backwards and whatever, you know, their standard project management stuff, I would have come to the same realization, but I probably would have spent 3 times as much money, 4 times as much time, and would have been 4 times as upset because
right.
I was so much further down the road.
Right.
Whereas we were able to really pivot and build on that we refocused on the concept and distilled it down. And what we came up with is what Saddleship's been for the past, you know, 6-7 months of really of being out there in the wild.
And what is that?
And like I said, it's a game. Mm-hmm. It's a game for sports fans. Then sports fans come to Saddleship every day, and they try to guess the outcome of various statistics. So that was the core idea of Saddleship. But what we realized is that actually predicting statistics just on their own is kind of boring. Mm. Like if you just said, for example, the very first idea I had was, let's take a hockey player and a hockey player, let's over his timeline from the beginning of the season to the end of the season, at what waypoints over the course of the season will he hit 10 goals or 20 goals or 30 goals? And you'll try to predict out that trend. Because at the core of my idea was, I don't know if you've heard of sabermetrics, but sabermetrics is a concept in, if you've seen Moneyball, that's yes. Sabermetrics, right? So sabermetrics says that objectivity is the only way to make solid predictions. So if you try to evaluate and predict a player's performance, you need to look at all his numbers over the past several years and distill all those numbers through various formulas and algorithms and say, take away all bias and say, this is the way he's going to be. And I said, well, let's flip that. Let's instead say, let's make all the predictions subjective. And what if we'd have a large enough group, and this is where wisdom of the crowds comes into play. Let's say we take a large enough sample size of just sports fans, where sports is probably one of the few things where you're allowed to be biased. You're allowed to be overly biased towards, you know, Tom Brady or, you know, David Ortiz or whoever. You're allowed to be biased because you're a fan. Fans are biased. It's just naturally. Mm. So if you're going to be subjective, if we get a large enough sampling pool, can that sample group of subjectivity outperform the objectivity of the formulas? Hmm. So that was the core idea. So taking that, we then said, well, what else do we like about sports? And what don't we like about sports and statistics, excuse me? Well, first of all, statistics is hard to say.
Yeah. Second, one strike.
Yeah. Secondly, statistics equals I'm in, you know, second year college math class or whatever. People think stats are nerdy and boring and hard to understand. But I don't know if you're a particular sports fan, but if you ask somebody, so why are the Red Sox going to win tonight? And they'll say, well, you know, Cody Ross just hit 7-for-11 over the past three games with two home runs. And they said, so I think he's going to do really well tonight, and that's why they're going to win. And then you ask them, don't you know that you're talking about stats? Like, no. I just know. I mean, you know, I like Cody Ross. So I just know the game. I just follow the game. Mm. So, Saddleship evolved into a game that's shaped around the way people talk about sports.
Mm. So you started learning, or you started coding Ruby as part of this project, right?
I did. Yeah.
So what was that like?
We did a couple things really well within the team. First of all, we had a small team. There were only three people, and then myself. Well, I guess we had, you know, a designer coming in from time to time. And I think for the first couple weeks, really just spent time, not necessarily looking over people's shoulder, but reading code over people's shoulder. You mm-hmm. know, getting the source out of Git and just reading. So I spent a lot of time just trying to recognize patterns, getting comfortable with syntax, getting comfortable with the reason why you guys don't put any comments, any code, which I understood right away. And I said, okay, if the code's complicated enough to need comments, then you probably should rewrite your code. Mm. But I thought that was kind of interesting. And then what I decided was the game needed an admin interface. We needed a way to add players or add stories, add games, add stories, write, you know, to actually the authoring component of the game. Because you guys would focus on, you know, the overall design, the scoring, you know, all that stuff.
Of user-facing stuff.
Right. But there was an admin interface that I needed, and that was perfect for me to sink my teeth into, because anything I would do in that space was not Critical Path. It wouldn't break anything of the outward-facing game. It let me take my time. It let me get comfortable with writing things. And admin interfaces are pretty basic. They're, you know, MVC, strict MVC stuff. So you know, take a game, create a game, story. I mean, basic
CRUD.
Right, basic CRUD, which when you're dealing with a consulting company with billable hours, you don't want to spend a lot of money on... Even when we were doing work for, you know, on the oil and gas logistics platform, clients would... This was before we productized, and they say, you know, we need admin interfaces for products and customers and vendors. And we'd throw them out there, and they'd look at the number and say, we're not paying that for, like you said, basic CRUD stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's still time and money.
Just you writing code these days?
It is. It is just me.
How are you continuing to grow your skills? Like, how are you still getting better?
That's tough. It's tough because there's a few things I miss about being in Thoughtbot. And when I say in Thoughtbot, I was actually at the desk every single day.
Right, in the office,
yep. Probably for an eight or 10 week project that we did. And what I miss most is that exchange of information and that exchange of skills. I think I'm expanding it at a much, much slower rate. But I'm always kind of cognizant of when I left Thoughtbot with Saddleship, I had a nice, small, very tight, clean code base that did hockey games. But the other part that I left two other things. One was kind of a philosophy. And then the third thing I left with was a test suite. And being a single developer, that test suite is probably worth 90% of what I paid in consulting fees with Thoughtbot. Because when you're one person and you need to deploy out on a day, that level of confidence that test suite gives you as one person, one person's eyes, one person's sensibility, without that, I don't think I could do it. I would break things left and right.
Absolutely.
And the philosophy of having, everybody says, and I'd heard it in every company, everybody writes test cases first and then develops. Thoughtbot was the first place I'd ever actually seen it happen, not only consistently, but like always. Mm-hmm. And I'd never seen that before. I'd like I said, I've heard people say it, but nobody I'd ever seen had ever done it before. Mm. And when I say I left with that philosophy, those things, that's been one of the more valuable things. Now, do I cheat when I'm one person just on my own? Yeah. But do I ever go back and say, I really shouldn't be doing it this way? I do. So I've got like a little Thoughtbot angel or devil on my shoulder saying,
okay.
You know.
At least letting you know that
you're
right.
Breaking the rule. Right. You know you haven't put a spec for this thing in yet, but I'm like, it's just a Boolean check or something stupid like that. And I can hear somebody say, write the spec first and do that for
it. So that actually brings me to another question, which is, if you were advising a friend of yours who was trying to do a similar thing, starting his own thing on his own, imagine he sort of had development chops already. Like, what would you summarize as the lessons you've learned? You've got, like, a few sentences to tell this friend.
Sure.
Something useful.
First, I would say, don't do it alone.
Okay.
That was the first thing I've learned, that it's not that it's harder to do something, to build something alone, but if you're starting a company, there are distinct disadvantages of being a solo founder. Second is...
What are those disadvantages, quickly?
For example, I wanted. We had looked into getting Saddleship into Techstars early on, and their response was, we just don't do solo founders anymore. Mm. It's too much of a risk. They want kind of a balance, even if you've had experience in one way or another.
Gotcha.
I think it's better that someone can focus on, let's say the product and then the marketing of it, because dividing those responsibilities or combining those responsibilities in one person, the marketing and launching and promotion of a startup, I knew it was going to be a lot of work, but I had no idea how much work it was. Mm. So having that balance, I think is would be really important. So
if you
have an opportunity to have a co-founder, and you know, I don't even care if you're like, well, it's mostly my idea, why do I give 50% to somebody else or whatever, you'll be benefit by having two people, I think.
Okay. And so more lessons learned then?
Other lessons learned about the...
Or recommendations to, you know, someone getting started.
There are a few things that were important that I find myself deviating from, which I probably should take to heart more, is, you know, having read the Lean Startup and those approaches, the ability to measure and evaluate your progress is key, because there's a few mistakes that I've made since, you know, maybe this spring, where I get a great idea, you know, a new feature, a new something, and I spend 3 weeks building it, but I don't measure it properly, or I don't do that. So I think always second guess your next great idea and keep things really simple. And if you are going to build a new feature, take the time to measure it and evaluate it to see if it's appropriate or not, because it's much easier, depending on what kind of personality you are. If you're the more gregarious marketing, I want to promote and push and, you know, put stickers on every lamppost type thing, or if you're more creative, oh, I want to make this be the best thing and I want to create new features, you can distract yourself very easily if you don't have somebody else second guessing you. So when you're a one person startup, you always think that you're right until you're wrong. Mm. The trouble is you find out that you're not necessarily wrong, but there could always be a better use of time if you're not too careful. Mm-hmm. Other things that are simple that I would recommend: don't work out of your house. Mm. I did that for, you know, I did consulting out of my house for a while, but then after I left you guys, I worked, you know, January and February out of my house, and maybe, you know, this wasn't even that bad of a winter, but it's just bad working out of your house. I mean, I know everybody thinks, oh, you startups out of garages and out of basements, and sure, but you know, your sleep cycle gets screwed up. You can't divide up your personal time versus your, you know, your work time, and things start to blend into each other, and you know, next thing you know, you haven't like left the house for a day, or you haven't paid your bills, or you get really confused. So in March, I got a small little office space, and after doing that, things got much better, because nice. You were able to really focus and divide up your time, and had this: when I'm here, I'm working; when I'm home, I'm still working, but I'm still home. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, you're monitoring, or you're thinking of new ideas. Mm-hmm. What else? The other, I mean, I was fortunate enough, I think the other important thing about startups is obviously money. I've been fortunate enough to be able to bootstrap Saddleship over the period of time. But I think it's wise to set some limits on what you're willing to spend, either through, if you're going to bring on a third party for consulting work in any capacity, if it's development or graphic design or, you know, marketing or whatever, that you have some strict budget limits and kind of work within those, because it's too easy to treat it like a hobby when you're one person, even though Saddleship is incorporated, it has a tax ID number, it's a company. There's a fine line where company and hobby blends, and it can be a strange feeling.
Is it a hobby? Is it a just a passion that you're doing that doesn't need to make money, or is it really a company?
Right. No, it needs to make money. it hopefully will. But I think setting up some strict limits on budget and giving yourself some hard timeline blocks to say you need to start having a revenue model by X or Y is important because of that. The hard part about trying to figure out how to make money on something is, I don't know, and maybe I'm wrong, is sometimes you only have one shot at things. Like, even with promotion, if you pick a certain revenue model, is that what you're going to be locked into? Are you going to annoy your existing user base if you start paying for charging for things? Or do you go with advertising? Or do you go with gambling? Because everybody says, oh, you're sports, you should do gambling. And that's just not what I want to do at all. So picking that type of revenue model, it's a big decision. So it can easily get pushed off too, because you don't want to make that somewhat critical mistake. What else?
Can you touch on things that have worked for getting people to the site in terms of marketing efforts?
Yeah. The two most successful, well, the three most successful things were, one, going to this trade show that was by MIT Sloan, ESPN. Mm-hmm. That, by being there, just having a trade show booth, that got the name out. And that was really the launch. That was back in March. Mm-hmm. That brought the most brought the most people to the site. So so focusing on a core demographic. These are sports people. These are people who watch ESPN every day. These are sabermetric people. These are stats people. These are tons of business school people who all want to go work for the Red Sox.
So you sort of found your audience and went to them and sort of got your
so
name out there.
Yeah. So instead of trying to just do broad-based Google AdWords sports game, because that automatically gets you into gambling and fantasy. Because if you put in enough keywords out of what Saddleship could be, Google thought it was a gambling site. In fact, I couldn't even get ads because they thought it was a gambling site. So instead, focusing on a very small market. Second was focusing on a geographic location. So obviously here I'm in Boston. So most of the games early on were Bruins, Patriots, Red Sox. So if you were going to do marketing, you could go to very small local blogs, Boston Bruins blogs, those type of things, and much, much cheaper and much more effectively reach a particular audience. So that was very good from early on targeting, getting in people that were interested in the concept and were interested at least in the geographic nature of the game. Other ways that were great has been Craigslist. My ad for interns probably brought in one of the largest, 3-day spikes of interest.
On the site itself.
Yeah.
Not the actual interns.
Yeah, yeah, no. The people who applied, I hired one out of the group.
Uh-huh.
Not all of them were great. Sorry if you guys are listening. But that was one of the
interesting
large ways to get, because I also it goes back into targeting a market. So I was going after sports authors in the Boston area. So if you're focusing on Boston games or whatever. So again, reaching out to that little market.
Yeah.
Other ways of traffic has been the inbound marketing approach, pushing a lot of the content to Twitter and the blog or a blog. That's brought a lot of traffic in. The conversion rates have been not as successful as either of those other two methods. Which has been an ongoing challenge, but that kind of works. And the last one, the most successful, is really word of mouth, people recommending it to their friends. But things that have not been successful have not been Facebook ads. They've been really not so great. Other traditional like ad posts have been mediocre. So it's really identifying, focusing in on that core market where you think they're going to be attracted. And I know they say, oh, you can target these people in Facebook. But there's so much noise out of that I think people are more apt to respond to something if they're open to it or looking for it rather than being shown it, kind of in a weird way.
Yeah. Huh. So if you had to summarize sort of quickly what you would consider success for the site, what would that look like to you?
I think success would be that people start thinking about Saddleship as people use Saddleship when they wake up in the morning and to get their little fix of sports, because a lot of people go, you know, wake up in the morning and they think about sports and they'll go to ESPN or Yahoo or whatever. And instead of sifting through lots of newspaper articles or, you know, tons of ads, it's just if you want to know in a very distilled way, like your little sports stats companion, that's what I keep thinking about Saddleship as being kind of a companion for your sports day, that would be successful, is that it gets that kind of cachet in the collective, mm-hmm. you know, world.
It's interesting that you don't bring up revenue first.
Well, revenue is like I said before, revenue models are strange, because you either if you do advertising, you have to have lots of users first. There's these chicken and egg things. And then I keep thinking, I don't know if you've watched the Newsroom, that show on HBO, mm-hmm. but I think in the first or second episode, they talk about news and whether or not ratings drives content. And, you know, the sales guy says, no, I don't want ratings to drive content. Meaning, do the lowest common denominator story, because 1,000 people will be watching, mm-hmm. you know, the cat in the tree, versus taking on, let's say, some economic issue. You know, the sales guy said, no, I want content to drive ratings. But that's never the case, and that's kind of the way I look at advertising. If I did an advertising based model, obviously you need lots of traffic to drive advertising. But then once you have lots of traffic, you then kind of need to alter your content to appease your advertisers. Now, what does that do to the game?
Yeah.
Can I not write games of a certain tone or a certain message like that? So. I'm not too sure. There's certain revenue models that are more appealing to me, and I think it comes down to, I go back to that data analytic mode of things, where you start seeing trends in fan behavior. And one of the concepts in the sports world, or at least in the sports business world, in order to retain, drive, and attract customers, because the Major League Baseball, you have customers. The customers are called fans. Boston Red Sox has customers, they're fans. And you want to keep them active, you want to keep them entertained. Knowing who they are and how they behave and what they like is something that is an underlying set of information that Saddleship gives. So, for example, I know out of my user base, these sets of users are Bruins fans. I know that this person is a Tampa Bay Rays fan because she always plays these games. Well, I know that more often than not, this person is more biased towards these players or not, based on how they vote. Some people will always go with their gut and say, you know, he'll score 3 goals, even though when it's not realistically possible. So I'm more interested, if I'm going to do revenue, in that analytic approach to information than, say, selling ads or giving away prizes of T-shirts and stuff like that, or you know, just because I think overall it's a more valuable commodity than traffic. It's just not that interesting to me.
Okay. What would make you quit? What would make you give up?
I don't think I would quit. What I think what I would do is I would go get a job and then make it a hobby.
Okay. Yeah.
It's whether or not Saddleship remains a company that I'm devoting 100% of my time to. I think what I would end up doing, if I had to, let's say I ran out of funds and I couldn't raise money, or you know, whatever happens, I think it would just shift into a hobby rather than a business.
Mm-hmm. That seems like a good sign. Like, you have the passion for it, whether it's a viable business or not. It's something that you want to work on.
Yeah, exactly. Because to be quite honest, I'm much more a hockey fan than I am a baseball fan or even a basketball fan. But with my interns writing these other games for me, I'm actually learning more about sports than I ever had before. Learning about, you know, who the better players are, where the milestones are, some of the historical context. It's actually quite an engaging thing to read, and And games are always great ways of to learn, because there's positive and negative reinforcement. You're forced to make an assessment. And I think if people want to start being re-engaging themselves in sports, then just not, you know, going to the ballpark and buying some nachos or you know, trying to buy a jersey. By playing these games, you start becoming more of a part of, you know, the whole culture, and I don't even know what to call it. Sports is strange, because it has its own little culture and its own set of stories. It's kind of like being wrapped in a world that only fans have to live in. it's kind of a little bit of a bubble, but but to get in there, it's not necessarily that accessible unless you've lived in it. So.
Okay, so I want to cover some of the events that we have going on in the next month or so. We mentioned in the last episode that Josh Clayton is going to be presenting Metaprogramming in the Wild, Source Diving in Factory Girl, and that is at the Lone Star Ruby Conference, August 9th through 11th in Austin. And also Mike Burns is presenting When Not to Use Object-Oriented Techniques, which is sure to definitely piss off a lot of people. That would be at Eurocamp in August 17th through 19th in Berlin. Our CEO, Chad Pytel, is going to participating in the Teaching Rails panel at Madison Ruby Conference, August 23rd through 25th in Madison, Wisconsin. And one other event, Joe Ferris, our CTO, is presenting a talk about how to improve the performance of your Ruby on Rails applications in the cloud. That'll be at Heroku in San Francisco on July 24th. 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. So if you'd like to ask us questions, we often answer them here on the podcast or on our blog. There's a couple ways you can get in touch with us. One is you can call us toll-free at 877-9-ROBOTS, extension 198, and you can leave a voicemail. You can also just email questions to info@thoughtbot.com or tweet to us at @thoughtbot. Now, finally, I just want to mention that I'm Ben Orenstein. I'm Rook on Twitter. I've been talking with David Tierson. You can get in touch with him through the Twitter account for Staddleship, which is just like Battleship with a B, or Battleship with an ST at the front.
Exactly.
On Twitter. And we'll have some links in the show notes to the site itself and anything else we talked about. But David, thanks very much for coming and talking to us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, take care.